From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. This hour, we bring together the candidates running for the Democratic nomination for the 136th District Assembly seat, seat that had previously been held by Jamie Romeo, who is seeking election to the Monroe County Clerk's Office. She was appointed to that role after former clerk Adam Bellow won his race for Monroe County Executive last year. The primary is June 23rd. Many New Yorkers will vote by mail before that date. Our goal is to bring candidates together for all statewide and federal races that will appear on your ballots. Republicans, Democrats, primaries, special elections. In this race, three Democrats are vying for the position. They include Sarah Clark, Nelson Lopatin, and Justin Wilcox. They're going to share their priorities, their ideas, and they'll answer your questions. And let me welcome them now. Sarah Clark has worked for U.S. Senators Hillary Clinton and now Kirsten Gillibrand. She's running for the seat. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Hello. Great to be here. Thank you.
Also with us is Nelson Lopatin, president of the Brighton Chamber of Commerce for the last 6 years, among other roles. Nelson, welcome to you.
Great to be on your show, Evan.
And Justin Wilcox, a member of the Monroe County Legislature since 2012, also running for the nomination here. Justin, welcome. How are you?
Great. Thank you for having me, Evan.
Let me ask all three of you why you are running, and why don't you do a little bit of an introduction of yourself, your background, and tell us why you decided to run. Sarah Clark, I'll start with you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. So I'm Sarah, a lifelong city resident in Rochester, went to East High School, and now live in Maplewood with my husband and three children. I, as you said, I've spent the last 19 years working in the United States Senate. It's given me a huge breadth of policy knowledge and two decades of working in our community with elected officials, community leaders, small businesses, nonprofits, neighborhood groups, advocates, you name it. And it's really allowed me to become a champion for our needs and what we see our community being in the future. But I'm also a huge volunteer. I volunteer at the United Way in their community impact cabinet, and at our local credit union on their nominating committee, and as a swim official at the Y for our swim team. So I just feel like I have this whole experience that really ties me to this community and makes me a great advocate in Albany. And I want to bring all that experience. I want to put it to work for us. It's a bold, sort of progressive, new, different voice in Albany. So I want to get to work for our community and advocate for the progressive democratic values that we hold so dear.
Okay. Nelson Lopatin, go ahead.
Thanks, Evan. I'm a graduate of Brighton High School, and I have a bachelor's degree in accounting from Bentley College. Excuse me. I started my career working as a public accountant with a focus on taxes and small business. And then after a few years, I took an opportunity to become an owner-manager of a motel and restaurant. That started a 20-year career in hospitality management that included development of a hotel. In 1995, I saw the potential of the Internet and started an Internet development and consulting business, developing and hosting websites, online databases and stores, and providing other services to help businesses access and utilize the Internet. I've been a political activist since college and have provided technology consulting services for many political campaigns and organizations. For example, I developed the Monroe County Democratic Committee's first website when Ted O'Brien was the chairman. I was technology consultant for Bill Johnson for county executive, member of the leadership team of Rochester for Obama, social media coordinator for Louise Slaughter for Congress, and technology manager for Sandy Frankel for county executive, twice. Now in my seventh year as president of the Brighton Chamber of Commerce, I lead our efforts helping member businesses and organizations succeed by providing networking events, seminars, which are both now online, and community promotional opportunities. Our goal is to build a healthy economy and improve the quality of life in our community. Now, I think we need to work to make changes in Albany. We need to get our fair share of state aid for our school districts and provide quality schools for our children. We need affordable health care for all and lower prescription drug costs. We need a strong advocate for small businesses and honest economic development that creates real jobs. We need better use of technology to help government agencies service faster, more effectively, and more efficiently. And we need to support investments in green technology to fight climate change. I don't just want to talk about change. I want to fight to make change. I will provide a new voice and strong leadership that will fight for real change for our families. That's why I'm running for state assembly. You can learn more about my campaign at votelowpatton.com.
All right, to be fair, I got to jump back to Sarah Clark. What's your website, Sarah Clark?
SarahClarkForAssembly.com.
Justin Wilcox, your website?
ElectJustinWilcox.com.
All right, Justin, tell us about yourself and why you're running.
Thanks, Evan. Yeah, a little bit about me and my background. My name's Justin Wilcox. Actually, it's Justin Free Wilcox. If you can't tell from my middle name, and if you haven't guessed it, my parents were actually hippies. They were also significantly only 18 and 19 years old when I was born. Out of the two of them, only one had a high school diploma. And unfortunately, to make matters a little worse for them, 10 months later after having me, they had my brother. So here they were, 19, 20 years old, two kids, one diploma. Now, my parents worked very hard. My father sold comics and coins at flea markets. He painted houses, he drove a truck, and he worked as a refuse collector. My mother, on the other hand, she worked as a waitress while earning her college degree in math and computer science. She was actually the first person in her family to graduate from college. And, you know, not surprisingly, you know, being very young parents, they moved us around quite a bit. We moved 12 times before I was actually 16. And after high school, I started a small roofing company, paid my own way through college. I graduated from UB in political science. I've worked in Albany. Like Sarah, I've been involved in politics and government for the past 20 years. I worked in Albany as legislative director for Joe Morelli, Senator Ted O'Brien, and Assemblywoman Jamie Romeo. I've been a county legislator for 8 years. I'm proud that the people of Brighton have actually returned me to that position 3 times. I live in Brighton with my wife, Linda, and our 2 children, Evelyn and Brennan. They're 19 and 17, respectively. So that's my background, and those early years are particularly important because they sort of formed and informed how I approach public policy. It's why I'm so passionate about issues that affect the disadvantaged. And I will say that, you know, I'm running for this office because I know how to turn pressing issues into successful legislation. For example, I was point for important bills in Albany on women's health and expanding medical insurance for New York's working families. I also worked with Assemblyman Morelli on passing national model legislation to regulate the destructive financial products that made Wall Street rich while destroying Main Street. And I, as a county legislator, worked successfully, obviously, to cut CPS caseloads after a series of unfortunate, tragic deaths. And most recently, I passed legislation to create a climate action plan. So I'm running actually because I've worked in this district and lived in it my entire life. I have the experience to take on important issues, and I actually have a record of getting results.
So let me ask all three of you. I'll start with Justin and work back across the group here. 3 candidates running for the 136th District Assembly seat, the Democratic nomination, the June 23rd election. Let's start with Justin and ask, priority one, if you are elected, you've all talked about where your passions lie, but what is the top of the list? What is either not getting done in Albany or something that you want to bolster or be a part of if you are elected? What's at the top, Justin?
Well, I think, you know, in this COVID world that we live in now, obviously we're going to have to address a number of issues, mostly relating to revenue shortfalls. So any issue that we're going to have to address is going to have to also sort of confront the hard realities of extreme revenue shortfall. So, you know, whether we're talking about health care or whether we're talking about education and employment issues, you know, it certainly is going to all be in the context of a serious declining revenue. But my number one priority would be obviously education. I think that is the number one priority for a lot of folks in this district. I think it is a very important issue in the city of Rochester. It's definitely an important issue in Brighton, with the foundation aid only providing about 50% of what was promised when the foundation aid formula was passed in reaction to the Campaign for Fiscal Equity lawsuit. And that's unfortunate because that's money that we're owed. It's money that every district is owed that's short of 100%. And there are a lot of districts short of 100% of foundation aid. The state has really only lived up to its promise to provide foundation aid, which is a formula based on need. And it's only done that for 1 year. So education would be my top priority.
Okay. Nelson LePatton.
My number one priority, without a doubt, is education. The education of our children is certainly one of the most important investments we can make in our future. And the foundation formula determines what each district is due and was designed to ensure that all schools have the resources needed to ensure every student receives a sound basic education. The state budget fails to provide a fair share of state aid to our districts. For example, Wester Underquist School District will receive about 66%. Brighton schools will receive only 50% of the state aid due based on the formula. The state owes the Rochester City School District more than $90 million in past due aid. And going back to Brighton for a minute, out of the 700 school districts in the state, Brighton is in the bottom 5%. This is not acceptable. All school districts need to get their fair share of funding. The formula that determines how the schools are to be funded is archaic and needs to be changed. And I know this is a tough year to get money. It's always tough to get money for education. But even if we can fight to split up the pool among the schools, the existing amount of money, that would bring all the school districts up to about 70%. So I would take that approach, at least to get started in getting our fair share of the funds.
All right, Sarah Clark, your first priority.
Well, I think this crisis has definitely put a sunlight on the disparities that face our communities. So what we all may be able to have sort of put in, you know, something that isn't a priority or we don't really see it has now been exposed beyond belief. So we really do have to use this opportunity to rebuild differently. You know, I worked in the Senate after 9/11. And after the Great Recession, and I did feel like we cared a little bit too much about Wall Street and big banks and stock buybacks than families and communities and people and children. So we have to take a holistic look and use this time, this moment in time, to do a better job. But education, I agree with both Justin and Nelson on this. It is a huge issue. The state has to commit to its it has to fully fund its commitment to education. I spent the last few months chatting with all the connections that I've made across the state, some of our assembly members and senators, and it looked promising that we were going to get a better round of education funding this time around, but then COVID hit and we got the financial crisis we're in today. I do think we're going to be dependent on the federal government, and I want to use that experience that I built over these 19 years to continue that championing that cause, but also all these connections that I've made and being able to sort of work with the assembly members and senators that I've already been working with and advocating with for so long. But it's also health. I mean, it's hard to separate the two because healthcare is also equally important for our children and our families, and the disparities are real. We need public health care. We need to make sure that we're more prepared for a crisis like this in the future and more resilient.
We're going to hit healthcare coming up here, but you all said education. So let me start with Nelson on this round of questions on the subject of education. You can talk about this foundation aid formula, which, as you said, was adhered to for about 1 year. And then we had a financial crisis. And for the last decade plus, every year we hear advocates say, well, you're not following the foundation aid formula. At this point, when you talk to people who work in government, I'm often told that it's sort of a dead issue. The people have moved on. The governor has certainly moved on. In a normal year, they think it might be a dead issue. Well, this is not a normal year. We're looking at a 20% cut in education from where we are now. And if you want to even talk about going back to the foundation aid formulas, a lot more money for a lot more schools, not just Rochester. I don't know where you're going to pay for it. Nelson, let's start with you. More money for schools is a nice idea if you can pay for it. Where's the money?
You know, more money for anything is going to be tough. Comptroller DiNapoli just said New York is facing economic devastation not seen since the Great Depression. So there's no doubt that the money is not there right now. We need to generate new revenue for the state. But I don't want that budget to be closed on the backs of our children, the sick, and the elderly. New York is home to some of the wealthiest people in the world. I support increasing taxes on the ultra-rich. Raising the state income tax and income above $5 million per year would add $2 billion in revenue. I also think New York should legalize the sale of marijuana. I read the other day that Colorado generated more than $1 billion in tax revenue during the first 5 years of legalizing commercial sale of marijuana. I'd also like to put on the table legalizing mobile sports betting. That could raise $200 million. On the other side of the coin, I want to take a look at cutting state expenses. I bet we can find programs that aren't needed and duplication of services in different agencies that can be cut.
Okay. Sarah Clark, how are you going to pay for an increase in education funding?
I agree on a lot of that. You know, we heard the governor talk about Bill Gates Foundation money coming in and whatever thoughts he may have of redesigning education. But I think if we're going to take billionaires' money, it doesn't have to be through foundations. We need to make sure that they're also doing it through our public system of taxes, which to me is more a public investment in our state and our kids and giving back all the resources that they've been able to earn for themselves when they get over these multi-million dollars and billion dollars. But we need to have a voice in how those revenues are spent in our school districts, not just through a foundation where they get to decide how they spend it. So I do support the wealth tax. We need to definitely look at revenue. I support legalization of marijuana, recreational marijuana, but it has to help the communities it's most hurt by the way that it's been enforced over the last few decades. And we have to rely on the federal government. I mean, it is going to be devastating if we take another 20% cut. So we have to have strong advocates who understand who the right people in the federal government are, using their resources like I have to make sure that we're making that case and getting what we need in the state.
Okay, Justin Wilcox, how are you going to pay for it?
Well, I think we got to start with looking at what we're talking about. Like when we talk about the foundation aid formula and how much we're falling short, I think we got to put it in perspective, right? We're falling over $3 billion short a year in what we owe the school districts. So any proposal that we have to put forward is going to have to generate at least $3 billion. That's if we keep the foundation aid formula, which, again, was created to create equity and if done properly, is based on need. So to generate $3.5 billion, you know, we're going to have to look at a number of things. We're going to have to look at, you know, legalization of marijuana and directing some of that money towards schools. Stock transfer tax, absolutely something we should examine. We're going to have to look at the carried interest loophole that would generate some hundreds of millions of additional dollars as well. A millionaire's tax. You know, we have a millionaire's tax now. It's been renewed at least twice, probably three times now, because that originally started post-financial crisis. And I agree with both my opponents that, you know, we could actually live with increasing that a bit. The danger, of course, with any of these taxes is it may have unintended consequences, right? You have to actually look to make sure that the additional revenues that you're generating actually aren't costing you more, right? That you're not taking a sector of Wall Street, which actually is, you know, the engine that finances the state. Unfortunately, I mean, that's just the reality. And so what you don't want to do is having those folks just move over to New Jersey. So we'd have to take a hard look at these things. It's something I would definitely take a look at. But like I said, you know, marijuana, stock transfer tax, carried interest loophole, and the millionaire's tax are all on the table.
Okay, and on that note, let me just make sure our listeners hear it very clearly here, because Justin's saying those should all be on the table here. And during Governor Cuomo's daily news conference today, Jesse McKinley from the New York Times flagged what I thought was an interesting question. He called it a very sharp question, and let me just make sure that we get it here. Here it is. So Zach Fink asked a question of the governor today. The governor was saying, look, when you have a crisis, there's a lot of people who get hurt. The people at the very top tend to bounce back almost all the way up. But he said it's not like a basketball bounce where it bounces right back up to where it started. The people at the top, maybe so. For others, it's more of sort of a thud. You bounce a little, but you're not coming all the way back up. To which Zach Fink said, well, if that's the case, why not raise taxes on the people at the very top if they're the ones doing great? And Jesse McKinley of the New York Times says, great question. Governor didn't really answer that. He has opposed it so far, and he emphasized putting the pressure on the federal government to bring in more revenue, more funding, I should say, not necessarily raising revenue through taxation at the very, very top. So, to clarify, Justin, if you're in the state assembly today, are you voting for, you know, an ultra-millionaire's tax, a super wealth tax right now, Justin?
Well, to be fair, I have never, ever voted on anything without actually studying it very deeply.
Have you studied this one yet?
Well, there's not enough data. Listen, if you talk to some folks, they'll tell you there's enough data and that we would drive millionaires out of New York. Look, I happen to know a few millionaires that have driven out. They have moved out of New York. I used to work for one. And so here's the thing. It actually does result, potentially, but you want to look at the overall effect, right? That's anecdotal. You want to look at studies that really show you the impact on the economy. So, look, I would definitely be leaning towards that if, in fact, the data that we have. And again, it doesn't have to be definite. I'm not saying I need something in front of me guaranteeing me the end result. That's not what you get in government.
I lost the
show. That's not what you get in the legislature. You don't get definites. You get as much information as you can, and you make as wise a decision as you can based on that information. So right now, looking at the information I have, I would say it's worth doing, but I would be open to taking a look at the data.
All right. Do we have Sarah Clark? I heard it just for a second. Sarah, are you there? Let's make sure we get back in touch with Sarah. Let's get Nelson Lopatin next on that subject. If you're a member of the Assembly, are you voting yes on this?
Let me just say I'm happy we've got the governor fighting to get federal funding because we're going to need a lot of it, and I'm sure he's going to do a great job. My answer on the millionaire's tax is yes.
That was a short answer. That's very,
yes.
Very direct. You're ready to vote yes right now?
It is yes. I'm ready. Let's do it.
All right. Sarah Clark, are you there?
I am here.
Okay, great.
I missed a little.
Okay. So if you're a member of the New York State Assembly, would you vote for that ultra-millionaire's tax right now? Justin Wilcox says maybe. He wants to study the data. Nelson Lopatin says yes. What do you say?
I say yes as well. I've already chatted with folks from the Assembly and various places, the senators from the Education Committee, and it seems we need to look at revenue, and people who are in the middle class shouldn't be paying at the same tax rate as our multimillionaires and billionaires. If they can give foundation money, they can, you know, give back some public investment with their tax dollars. So yes, the answer is yes.
And let me follow up with Nelson Lopatin, who had this to say during a video that he put out regarding his candidacy for the seat. You said that voters are tired of recycling the same party insiders and career politicians from one office to another. Nelson, I want to ask you if you think that's fair as a categorization of your opponents in this race who are on the line with us here, and they're talking about their qualifications, their experience, the people that they know and know how to get things done. You're saying it's the other way around. You're saying voters don't want that. Why do you say that?
I'm saying voters are tired of dealing with that. We've done that in the past. We've heard candidates say they were going to hit the ground running, and they hit the ground with a thud. So I'm going to let the voters decide whether I'm correct this time, but I'll stay with that statement.
Okay. Sarah Clark, how do you feel about that statement, that voters are tired of recycling the same party insiders and career politicians from one office to another?
I understand that. I don't feel like a career politician. I've been a staffer for 19 years in the Senate. It's basically been focusing on constituent work and policy work and our community, not the political side of campaigns. And I do think it's built a vast network of connections that I do think are very useful in terms of making alliances and getting to hit the ground day one. But I have also learned, too, I am a big proponent of shining light and doing whatever we can to make sure the process is transparent, people are held accountable, and people feel included. So I too, you know, getting to know Albany and understand how bills are made and some of the deals that are made, and they're behind closed doors, we need to change that. We need to bring everybody into the process. We need to make sure there's a light on it. Bills shouldn't be approved by industry groups. They should be approved by the people in the districts. And so I don't bring the career politics to it. I bring just a knowledge of public policy and what our community needs.
Okay, Justin Wilcox.
Well, I think if you take a look at the people that are continuously reelected here, like myself, and Adam Bello and Joe Morelli, I think the voters actually do differentiate. So I think they look to those people who represent them, those people who are effective, those people who are especially in the Democratic Party who are strong progressive voices. I have fought locally the Republicans for the past 8 years. on, mismanagement of county finances, corruption, ethical lapses, you name it. And I have a credible record of success in getting results. So I would say this, the voters differentiate. They know who the quote-unquote career politicians are, and they also know who the folks who represent their interests are. And I would again turn to people like myself who've been reelected twice. I've been elected three times. Adam Bellow, who was an Irondequoit, and then he was the county clerk, and now he's the county executive. And Joe Morelli, who served for a long time as my mentor, who I worked for, who taught me my style of politics and who taught me public policy and taught me that you listen to all sides and you do collect information before you make a vote. You just don't grandstand and you just don't play to the base. You study the information. You make sure you make a wise choice because people's lives are in the balance.
All right, listeners, we're going to take our only short break of the hour. And when we come back, we have some audience questions and I've got some more questions for the candidates who are Democrats running for the nomination on June 23rd for the 136th District Assembly seat. That's a seat that had previously been held by Jamie Romeo, who is now seeking election to the Monroe County Clerk's Office. And she, of course, was appointed to that role after former clerk Adam Bellow became the Monroe County Executive. Sarah Clark, Nelson Lopatin, Justin Wilcox, all vying for the seat. They are all with us, and we will continue with them after our only short break. I'm Evan Dawson, Wednesday on The Next Connections. If you had fallen asleep in February and you woke up this past weekend and you parachuted into the port of Rochester, would you have been able to tell that anything about the world was different? Maybe not. Didn't really look like a pandemic this weekend. A lot of people out, partying, having a good time. Doesn't mean that they shouldn't be out. The question is, how do we adjust appropriately when the weather warms up? We'll talk strategies Wednesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. And Sarah Clark, you invoked healthcare in one of your initial responses. Let me ask all three of you, and I'll start with Sarah on this. Where are you on New York State's healthcare offerings? I mean, are you someone who wants to see the New York Health Act? Do you want single payer at this level? Has anything changed in your view based on the pandemic? What would you vote for today?
Yes, I do believe in the public option single payer system in New York. I would hope that we get it on the national level soon. Again, I think this pandemic has only shown us time and time again the health disparities. You know, the numbers that we were hearing were that 95% of New Yorkers were covered by health care, and we only had to worry about 5%. But of those 95%, a huge portion of them aren't going to the doctor because they can't afford their deductibles or their co-pays or the expenses that come with it. It's still not affordable to people. We have been battling this issue for 20 years. It has been the highest priority when I started, and it is still one of the things I hear the most about. People who can't pay for their prescriptions, people who choose between food and medicine is not okay in our country. We have to get to a single-payer system. We have to make healthcare a right for everybody that they can afford, that they can access, and that it is equitable for everyone.
Okay. Nelson Lopatin.
I believe healthcare is a human right. I support the New York Health Act. It's comprehensive universal health coverage for every New Yorker. No more copays, deductibles, or premiums. I'm in favor of it.
Justin Wilcox.
Well, I started by saying my mother was a math major, and I actually follow in her footsteps in that regard in the sense that I take a look at the numbers. And New York Health Act, the numbers don't add up. So I don't know if my opponents have actually taken a look at the RAND report. And the RAND report does actually go into quite extensive detail, and it seems to be pretty favorable with respect to the way it's looking at the New York Health Act, but it has a couple caveats, right? It says, look, you know, the numbers that we're putting out here, you know, we think, you know, there's potential for like 2%, 3% savings, but that's based on some very important caveats. And one of those is that the federal government's going to give us a series of waivers, which the federal government has not been doing. So I'm surprised to hear my colleagues say that, knowing that the federal government has not given us waivers. And so much of the math that's in the New York Health Act is dependent upon those waivers. I'll give you a for example. A for example is that 40% of the New York State marketplace is covered by what's called ERISA plans. ERISA plans are not regulated by New York State. New York State does not regulate them. They're self-insured plans, most of them. federal government regulates those. The presumption is that we're talking about every single New York premium payer being under the New York Health Act, and that's simply not possible, not right now. So that's why I support it being done at the federal level. The economies of scale there are appropriate. The federal government has oversight over ERISA plans. And so universal health coverage, absolutely. Basic human right, absolutely. New York State doing it, math doesn't work.
Okay, so what does work
Evan,
in New York?
Can I respond?
Yeah, Nelson people? And Sarah will definitely both have a moment to respond to that. But Justin, let me just ask then, is there something that you are for, if you're against that, is there something that you are for in terms of changing, or do you feel like the status quo is as good as it can get?
No, the status quo is definitely not as good as it gets. And I was part of making major reforms with Assemblyman Morelli when I was legislative director. We expanded health care coverage to young adults in New York State. We already much of the ACA actually is based on current New York State law. Pre-existing conditions were already covered in New York State. So many of the things that the ACA did were already law in New York State. What we did is we took it a little further. Assemblyman Morelli and I, we also approved prior approval of health insurance rates so that the insurance companies had to submit their rates to the Department of Financial Services to get approval before they could actually implement those rates. So the Department of Financial Services look at those rates for adequacy. They ensure that the dollars that are under law required to be spent. Now, remember, already in New York State, it's law that 85 cents of every premium dollar must go to health insurance coverage. That's a fact. So that's what they analyze it for. They want to make sure that the rates that they're approving, that 85 cents, is in fact going to health insurance coverage. And, I'm proud that that we did that.
Sarah Clark, I'll let you start, and Nelson next here. So he says he's surprised to hear you'd support this and knowing that some of the federal hurdles to making the math work on a state level here. What do you say to that, Sarah?
Well, I say it's just has not been working for 20 years. We've been and part of it, we had Obamacare dismantled by the Trump administration. But the single payer system, even if you just take Medicaid, we use what's called a managed care organization model to run Medicaid, federal Medicaid dollars through, which gives money to for-profit insurers like United Healthcare and WellCare. We are of the 38 states that use this model. We are one of the most expensive. We are not even single payer for Medicaid. We are shipping money off to for-profit insurers instead of to people for medical services that they need, to doctors for the reimbursements that they need, and to hospitals. We have so much that we can look into to make it a robust, better public system that takes the money out where it doesn't need to be and put it in where it does.
Nelson Lopatin.
Well, change is never easy, and certainly changing health insurance company is one of the big ones that's hard to change. But we have to get the insurance companies out of the equation. I'm aware of the waivers that are required. I'm familiar with the RAND report. I'm in favor of working towards the New York Health Act. 90% of New Yorkers are expected to pay less than they pay now.
With those assumptions, let's be clear, with those assumptions.
Nelson, anything you want to add there?
I finished my thought.
Okay.
And then Justin said that with those assumptions, and yes, with those assumptions.
Well, those assumptions are not going to happen. The federal government is not going to give us the waivers. So those numbers are not real. They're imaginary. They're illusory.
Sarah,
I don't take any donations from insurance companies.
Okay.
Well, hold on a second. Let's be clear. I would want to say one thing about that. 4,000 employees are Excellus in place located in Rochester area. I think that one thing we have to actually take into account, because again, this is why I like to look at numbers. This is why I study the data. I don't want to make a rash decision. I don't want to grandstand. I don't want to pander. It's easy to pander. People are not going to necessarily look into whether my numbers are correct. But here's the thing. What you want to do is you want to look at the numbers. You want to make sure that what you're doing makes sense for your community. Knowing that we have a large employee base here, that's going to lead to major unemployment if we were to do this. Look, we're not going to do it. The governor's not done it. There's a reason why, because he knows we're not going to get those waivers. But if we were to go down this path, we have to do it intelligently. We have to do it thoughtfully. The reason being is we have 4,000 people in the area, roughly, approximately that much, that would be unemployed. So we have to think of the ramifications. I'm not saying you don't do it because of 4,000 people. I'm saying you have to understand the ramifications.
All right. And Sarah, you want to add to that too? Go ahead.
I would just say that of those 4,000 people, healthcare is not going to go away. It's just about where does the money go? Where does the money go to hospitals and doctors and to pay jobs for in the healthcare industry? Absolutely. But does it go to big, huge million-dollar bonuses and for-profit companies that pay shareholders? That's my motive behind everything.
Well, Evan, if I might add, the model that they're saying they endorse does take health insurance companies out of it. So I'm not sure what they're looking at. At least Nelson was honest, and he said he wants insurance companies out of it. I don't know what proposal we're backing if we're saying we want health insurance companies still involved.
It's not the health insurers, it's the workers. They have a wealth of knowledge and experience that I think we would still, there's still going to be jobs. You still have to process claims. You still have to, it's not like those jobs go away. You need computer IT people who can have these systems. There's a lot of other, it's not like healthcare jobs go away. It's just a matter of where does the money go, how are they paid, and who benefits the most from the system.
Okay, so a point of difference from among some of the candidates on healthcare. Let's move to a question from the audience. Listener on Twitter asked, can they be specific? How would they protect tenants and prevent homelessness in our community? Nelson Lopatin, I'll let you start.
Well, certainly affordable housing is a big issue in our community in New York State. I think we're probably the worst, I think we're the third worst state for affordability of housing. Housing costs normally should average around 30%. In our community, I think we're up in the 50% range in many communities. So certainly subsidies are needed, tax credits. I'd have to study more to give a more detailed answer.
Okay, Sarah Clark.
So the housing first model is really the approach. We've seen it even here in the crisis and some of the work that I'm doing every day with people here who are struggling with housing and homelessness issues, is if you go to a housing first model, there's nothing that makes people feel more, if they feel taken care of, if they feel their basic need of shelter and maybe a bathroom to have access to, other things will come. If they need mental health services or drug recovery or whatever, we can help that. But housing first has to be the basic right. We need to move to that model quickly. Rent is still very expensive in our communities, very expensive considering the, particularly in the city of Rochester, considering the average median income. So we have to definitely have more affordable housing. We have to make sure that, again, you always can follow the money a little bit here and see how our policies are made and who's benefiting from them. And we need to have a clear vision. The Citywide Tenant Union and other folks are doing amazing work and advocacy around this to look at how we can change these policies to better serve the people who need housing versus the investors in housing.
Okay, Justin Wilcox.
Well, I think much of what Sarah has said is on the money. It's on the nose, actually. I would say that, you know, probably out of the three of us, I've probably been the only one that moved 12 times before they were 16. I tell you, I faced housing insecurity. I know what that's like. I know what it's like to sleep on a mattress, and just a mattress, for months. I will tell you, this is one of those issues that's near and dear to me. The advocates are doing an incredible job, like Sarah said. You know, they need partners in government that actually understand how government works. They need partners in government that know that, you know, this is the kind of really important issue that, you know, it takes somebody who's thoughtful, who looks at the numbers, who looks at the data, who has relationships already established in Albany, that's going to be able to get some things done. And this would be, after education, I got to tell you, this would be right up there because we really need to address this issue. It's near and dear to me. You know, these folks, I go to the House of Mercy, and I got to tell you, Sister Grace does a great job over there. It's just amazing how big a heart she has and the fact that she's providing a place for people to sleep that would have nowhere else because our housing policies are broken. These are people with mental health issues, drug addiction issues, and they're being told, no, you can't come here. That's a failure on our part. And again, I, you know, God bless Sister Grace.
Let me turn to a couple of other subjects before we lose the hour with the candidates who are running for the 136th District Assembly seat in the Democratic primary on June 23rd, though, of course, we say it's on June 23rd. It's also now to June 23rd. If you have your absentee ballots and you've sent in those applications and you want to vote by mail during this pandemic, Sarah Clark, Nelson Lopatin, Justin Wilcox, all with us. Justin, I'll start with you. A lot of talk in this state about bail reform in the last year. Of course, there was a passage of bail reform. Then a lot of advocates, including Sheriff of Monroe County, Todd Baxter, saying that some of the intentions were good, but some of the scope of the bail reform was too much, that there had to be a rollback of sorts. Where have you been on this this issue as you've seen it evolve? What would you vote for? What would you have voted for? What would you like to see sort of maintained as we go forward with bail reform?
Evan, thank you for asking the question. This is a great example of what I've been talking about with respect to the other issues we discussed, you know, whether we're talking about single-payer health care or any of the other issues where we really want to take a close look at the information we have, because this is exactly what happened. And the people that actually drafted this bill will tell you this is what happened. The bill was rushed, and there were flaws in it. And we fixed those flaws in the budget process. So when people like Todd Baxter and the district attorneys come out and they say, look, and the judges, and say, he made a mistake. Look, you did some well-intentioned, but you really should have talked to us because, you know, we know a little bit about this. This is what I'm saying I learned from working with Joe Morelli. You do talk to everyone. You don't rush. You don't pander. You don't grandstand. You're thoughtful. You're systematic in looking and examining the implications, because we did end up going back and correcting that bill. I'm 100% in favor of what we did. It was the right thing to do. Justice has to be blind. Has to be blind. It is unbelievable that people in this day and age, simply because they don't have the same size bank account as another person, get a completely different system of justice. To this extent, they could commit exactly the same crime. One person's released and one person can spend weeks in jail simply because their bank account's not as big as the other person. We corrected that, and I'm proud that we corrected that.
Okay, Nelson Lopatin.
Well, the bail rules were changed to address what was an unfair bias in the system against the poor. And it eliminated cash bail for low-level offenses, and it led to instances of defendants being released and then actually going out and getting arrested again for the same crime. So I'm in favor of the change, giving judicial discretion.
Sarah Clark.
I think one of the problems, it was a rushed bill. I think we could have included more stakeholders in the conversations when this was being discussed. But I also think there was a misconception about what bail is. Bail is only about a return to court. And so you shouldn't be punished for that if you're poor. I think one of the things I've learned over the years and who I've worked with, we've tried to do this even looking at a national level, is right here in Rochester, we have Measures for Justice. The biggest thing they said is the problem is we don't have the numbers. Our courts, our local courts, our county courts, our state courts don't report the numbers along demographics. And we need to have a better system that actually can look across the state and understand our pretrial services, what happens if we have diversion courts, who's getting bail, who's paying it, who has to stay in jail. Measures for Justice has been able to do this in much more forward-thinking states on this that have really started to collect and look at those numbers. And they can actually make policy that looks into it and helps people, lowers crime, does all the things we want to do, but also isn't biased and doesn't punish people for being poor or black. This is what we need to do.
All right.
If I might add, Evan, I completely agree with what Sarah just said, because one of the flaws in the bill still is the fact that we don't put enough money into pretrial services. We used to have those here in Monroe County. We don't have them anymore. They were a major, major component of what we did right here in Monroe County, making sure that we monitored folks, got addiction services for people who needed it. Those pretrial services are so important, and I think, you know, if I go to Albany, it's one of the things I'm going to emphasize, that we need to put more money into that.
All right, listener named Mark wants to know, what are the candidates willing to vote for when it comes to climate action? Be as specific as you can. Sarah Clark, go ahead.
Sure. I am a pro-environment, as a mom of three young children, a voice that isn't often in Albany in our legislatures. I care very much, obviously, about the world we leave behind for our children. I'm in support very much of some of the environmental bills that were passed and the things that we're doing. But one of the things I've done, I think we need to be aggressive on moving 100% to renewables. We have an electric grid here in the Finger Lakes region that is supported by both nuclear and water and less fossil fuels than other places. But as Ginna comes offline, we're going to have to make sure we're ready to continue on a renewable path to make the goals that we've laid out by 2030 and 2050, which I wholeheartedly agree in. One of the things that I was able to do in my federal role is the Finger Lakes National Heritage Corridor. It's not just about moving to renewables. It's also about preserving and protecting our lands and our waters and our air. Getting anything passed in Congress, as you can imagine, is hard. So the fact that it took us 5 years is both amazing and not. But we passed the Finger Lakes National Heritage Corridor study. The National Park Service is currently underway right now looking at that. But that would give us the ability to make sure we're protecting our region while also exploring it and making sure it is a magnet for tourism and culture and all the things that we hold dear. I also was very, you know, we helped elevate voices on fracking and making sure that that ultimately has now been banned permanently, but we were the ones that sort of helped elevate those voices, underground gas storage, all these things that really were just damaging to our community. I used my role to really elevate those voices and make sure we were heard so that we were moving to a renewable green community, a policy that would really make a difference in our lives and for the country. But we still have to push at the federal level. We have to get to a point where there's some price on carbon. We're never going to really move the needle until there's a national plan there. New York continues to be a leader. We need to stand up to the Trump administration and all the destructive policies. And I want to do that day one.
All right. Nelson LePatton.
I agree with almost everything Sarah just said. I fully support the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act that sets aggressive, enforceable goals for New York to cut down on greenhouse gas emissions. And that's where I'm at on that.
Justin Wilcox.
Yeah, you're not going to find a lot of daylight between us on this issue, especially since I actually passed historical legislation at the county level to create a climate action plan. This is the first time that Republicans have actually admitted through their sponsorship and passage of this legislation that climate science is real. So that historical legislation, which I worked on with my colleagues, and I'm very thankful to Adam Bellow, who's just been a great collaborator on these issues with me, was willing to sign that and worked closely with the legislature on this. We did this on a bipartisan basis. This was legislation I had introduced last year, and my colleagues on the other side had approached me, and they wanted to do something on this, and I'm really glad that we did. So, like most of these issues, I have a record. It's a record I'm proud of, what I'm going to do is the same thing I have done. So I'm going to lead on this issue.
About a minute apiece to finish with the response to Jared's email. He was talking about health care, but he's also talking about government in general. He says anything can be willed into existence if you really want it. Many Democrats want state health care. I'm surprised all Democrats don't support it. Justin, I'll let you start because I know he essentially addressed that to you, but really that's a general question about government, and that's for Jared. Please keep it to about 45 seconds to a minute if you can. Go ahead.
Well, I think Jared knows that not anything can be willed into existence. I do, however, think that we can always, when we try hard, when we actually focus on an issue, we will get positive results. I right now, if we all wished and hoped that Trump was no longer president today, unfortunately, as much as we wished it and willed it today, that's not going to happen. Hopefully, it'll happen in November. So let's all hope for it and will that into existence. That is something worth willing for. But here's what I will say. I absolutely agree on the principle that he's advocated, that we can get things done even if they're difficult. I've done it time and time again. I have done it in the county legislature. I've actually passed two pieces of legislation as a minority member, the Charter Review Commission and, in fact, the Climate Action Plan. That does not happen often.
All right.
So I do agree with him.
All right. Nelson Lopatin, about 45 seconds. Go ahead.
Very quickly, the wish to get rid of Trump is a good one, but I think we're going to work hard to make sure that it happens. And if you know how to build a consensus, you have strong leadership and negotiating skills, I believe we can get anything done.
Sarah Clark.
I think that, you know, we have to look at the values we have as a community and as a state and as a resident. What are we willing to do? We do need the will, but we also need the vision. We have to get there. We have to bring everyone with us. We have to recover better. It is a matter of priorities. I've been proud to work for Senator Gillibrand and Senator Clinton. I'm also proud to have been mentored by Louise Slaughter and getting advice from her. If we're not bold on our vision, then we're never going to get to a better place.
One more time for the audience, if you want to learn more about these candidates, Sarah Clark, your website?
SarahClarkForAssembly.com.
Nelson Lopatin.
Learn more and get a stay home, stay safe lawn sign at VoteLopatin.com.
Justin Wilcox.
It's electjustinwilcox.com.
I want to thank all three of you for taking the time. And listeners, this is part of our effort to bring the candidates together running for the various nominations and offices in the special and primary elections coming your way June 23rd. Many of you will be voting by mail, and this is your chance to hear them together. Justin Wilcox, Nelson Lopatin, Sarah Clark, thanks to all three of you for joining us today.
Thanks, Robin.
Wonderful conversation with them, and thanks for listening on this beautiful but hot Tuesday afternoon. The whole team here thanks you. Rob Braden is the engineer and Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Stay cool. We will talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.